It is Saturday, February 17, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek News segment, followed by your questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we're taking your calls and questions of technology. That's, of course, during the second half. The first half, we're going to be doing a news segment. So in the second half, please call us up, 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour.
Beginning Tuesday night at 10 p.m., listen to the 10th Annual Homelessness Marathon, continuing through 2 a.m. Wednesday morning. Listen to discussions on such topics as tent cities and homelessness, domestic violence in the homeless community, and homelessness abroad. And host Jeremy Weir Alderson will take live calls during the 10th Annual Homelessness Marathon, Tuesday night at 10 p.m. through 10 a.m. Wednesday morning on KUSP.
This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Good morning, Lyle.
And Miles Elam, student, programmer.
Student.
Welcome.
Student programmer.
Before we're going to take calls during the second half of the show. During the first half, we're going to just talk about some technology in the week. And Miles, I'd like to start with you.
Sure. Here's an area that I have to admit I don't think about very often, but we probably should. Server power consumption has doubled over the past 5 years. And I don't know if it's necessarily because we have more servers, although we do. It's because we are using more electricity for those servers. CPUs are using more power. The components in the computers are using more power. And I would imagine this is also true of desktops, but that's just hyperbole because I don't actually have
some
data
figures
on that.
So these figures are released by whom? I mean, who knows about all the servers in the world kind of thing? Is it just kind of a collection of buildings that have high-speed access?
Oh, sure. Make me look up my source.
Oh, my gosh.
I see how it is.
Well, it makes sense. I would assume that it's not, well, it's probably more computers, but it's also just, you know, more powerful computers. I mean, we recently upgraded our machine. We went ahead and put a 600-watt power supply in it. And it before had a 300-watt power supply. So
yeah, AMD was sponsoring a study done by Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
Okay, so it's a pretty—it's probably a pretty relevant study.
Yeah, although there is some expectation that virtualization may help out with that.
Well, what first off, the servers we're talking about are like what hosts internet websites, things like that,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, what's virtualization?
Virtualization is having a server within a server, if you will. You have a single physical box, but inside there are virtual machines. In other words, the computer is pretending like there are five machines within a single machine.
Okay,
it's kind of hard to describe.
It's kind of like running the operating system as an application inside an operating system, like a Microsoft Virtual PC on a Macintosh, or I don't think there's a Macintosh version for Windows,
right.
But it's not an uncommon thing. It's kind of an emulation mode.
Right. It is absolutely emulating a computer. So you have applications that think they're running on a machine on the computer, but actually they're running inside a piece of software on that.
Why would that reduce the amount of power consumption a server facility would need?
Because what we're finding with virtualization is that we're using the resources of a machine more efficiently. Instead of having five machines where each of them may be only used, 30% of their total capacity.
Sure.
You're putting all of those onto a single box that's much beefier, but you're consolidating the power supply, the components, the motherboard, the CPU.
Now, why not just run all of the stuff out of one machine? Why have these virtualization? What does it give you?
It gives you some flexibility because a lot of services, like a lot of mail servers or the like, may not use up all the capacity on the server. It means that instead of having five different servers trying to get that same component out
there. Are you talking about five different mail servers for five different people? Instead, you have one computer and you have five virtuals for handling five different servers?
Well, no. When you send mail, a lot of times you want to have more than one mail server. So if one goes down, you can still get your email.
Okay.
And before, what you had to do was just double the number of physical boxes that you have. With virtualization, you can simply put all of the services on a single box and have virtualization on a second box so that if one...
Gotcha. Okay. It also is convenient for... It also works well for backup because you can actually save these virtual machines relatively easy and put them on new hardware, and it doesn't matter what hardware it's on.
Right, and that's one of the things that we're trying to look for with our own servers,
which we've been doing. I've been learning a lot in the last couple of weeks about virtualization. Thank you very much, Miles, for that story. I think we're going to try to get. Well, maybe we're not. I was going to see if we could get Alex on the phone, but I don't actually see that he's awake this morning.
No, he is awake, but he's taking a. Taking a trip to the Griffith Observatory with his little sister.
So. all right. Well, thank you, Miles, for that news story. Sean, would you like to treat us with one?
Sure. So we all know that Google stores lots of data. They have a lot of servers and a lot of hard drives that store the data in those servers. So they use really interesting monitoring software to monitor environmental factors of the server room, such as temperatures and hard drives, activity levels of the hard drives, and smart parameters, which are built into modern hard drives. SMART is an acronym for self-monitoring analysis and reporting technology.
This has been around in hard drives, in consumer hard drives for
a while, yeah. So pretty much drives that were put into production in or after the year 2001 number more than 100,000 for Google.
Wow.
And they're monitoring these drives. So they're coming up with some interesting data about how drives fail.
Okay.
So it seems that the largest, there's a higher probability for failure in the first few months of a hard drive when it's put into high activity. So generally, if a hard drive can last 6 months, it's typically going to last at least 2 to 4 years.
Okay, so the first 6 months of getting a brand new hard drive, it might fail?
Yeah.
Is it pretty common for it to fail?
Well, it seems to be the percentage of failures are much higher in those first 6 months.
All right.
And then the rate jumps to about 8% in year two. Well, it kind of levels off at 8% in year two, 8.6% in year three. Year four is kind of average too. And then year five, they really start to fail.
They all die.
Which makes sense because most drive manufacturers warranty their drives for 5 years.
Sure.
They've got their numbers too, and they probably chose that number for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so are these SCSI drives or are these IDE?
These are IDE consumer drives, as I can tell.
I wonder why Google's using IDE consumer drives. I guess cheapest possible.
And they're typically of speeds of 5,400 RPM and 7,600 RPM. Something that they found, though, this is really interesting. Environmental factors really don't play a significant role in hard drives.
When a
drive is, because they're monitoring environmental factors of all their drives, and they take all this data, analyze it, and they've found that lower temperatures actually increase the chance of a drive failing.
Really?
Yeah, drives fail more in a cooler environment than they do in a warmer environment.
Wow, that's
unless you get to extreme levels of heat. Then they start
right, then everything fails, burns up.
Kind of interesting.
All right. Well, so Google decided to release all this information openly.
Yeah, there's a lot more here. There's other things that you can get into as far as when you reallocate a hard drive, so when you remap it so that faulty sectors are moved to physical new locations to try and get more life out of a hard drive, those drives really fail. over a period of time, a much shorter period of time, the percentages are much larger. There's a lot of data here, and we'll put the link up at geekspeak.org.
Geekspeak.org. Miles, will you handle that one? putting up this article. Sean and Miles, if you join us the Yahoo chat, that'd be great. We use Instant Messenger to deal with the show in details. And Didi just sent a note saying that we've mentioned Google Mail before Gmail, since we're talking about Google. They offer a free large, you know, two terabytes of, no, is it terabytes? No. 2 gigabytes of storage.
2 gigabytes.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's right.
Except it keeps raising.
They keep raising the bar when people run into
it. Yeah, the beta's over.
No, the beta's still going on, but the open enrollment's available. It used to be that you'd have to contact the geeks, and we didn't send you an invite because we all had a lot of invites. But now you don't need invites to join Gmail. You can just go to gmail.com, create an account. It's a good web interface.
I'm kinda,
email. You don't like it?
I don't like that.
You don't like it that it's open?
Yeah. Because it just makes it open now for spammers and so on to start getting these email addresses and start sending things out. And then what that's going to mean is a lot of sites, you need an email to register, and they don't accept emails from Hotmail, and they don't accept emails from Yahoo. Now I guess they won't accept emails from Google.
Because people make fake accounts?
Yeah. It's much easier for people to make a fake account now.
Okay.
But I think what Google's been doing, actually what all of the major email services have been doing, because they've been getting a lot better in the last couple of years, is that they've been watching, because they have so many users, they're able to watch patterns for how much a particular user is spitting out. Like, is it a new user that just sent out a whole bunch of the same message to a lot of different people? And so, I mean, that may come into play where a new message comes in and suddenly it's trying to mail out, even if it's not to Gmail customers, if it's out to everyone else, that they can track that and go,
hopefully.
It before the message goes out.
You know, I've been using both Gmail and Yahoo rather heavily. And, boy, the Gmail interface is just amazing. I love it.
Yeah, I've been using the Gmail interface since our mail
went down. It's
so fast. It's wonderful.
And it's very intuitive.
Are you using the key commands?
You know, I have not even used the key commands.
You've got to use the key commands. C composes a message. Y archives the message selected. You can move up and down your queue with J and X and K. It's just great. You just go to help. It'll open a new window. Okay. And then you go to, I think it's my inbox. There's the inbox link, and you look on that.
And their spam is just amazing.
Spam block.
I look
good.
In my spam folder every now and then to see if something got passed through. No.
What's interesting is that the spam, there's so much spam happening for our accounts because we don't have gray listing on anymore. We're just forwarding all our mail to our geekspeak.org addresses to Gmail. And, I notice a lot of spam. We weren't getting that kind of spam when Miles had made gray listing work. And I will have gray listing working on the new system, which will be virtual, by the way, virtual server. All right, next news story. Thank you for, that was mine. Well, that was Dee Dee's. Miles.
Something that I've come across is the popular meme that people should be, modern, you know, kids these days aren't reading newspapers like the older generation did. And that this is generally regarded as a bad thing. And yet, one thing that I was wondering about just the other day was, well, what about the landfills? The amount of newspaper that goes into landfills. And yes, we can recycle them.
And we probably do recycle.
And we do recycle to some extent, but to a large extent, we don't. I mean, newspapers, a huge number of newspapers end up in the landfill every year. And so I ended up getting a little curious about this topic and went to look and find out, well, what is in our landfill? And there was a 20-year study.
Did you get a shovel and like... No, okay, 20-year study.
There was a 20-year study, and it was published in the Smithsonian. And it's called The Garbage Project. It was conceived in 1971. And what it was finding was something that... A few things that really surprised me, which were one of the things that we assume was things like fast food containers, polystyrene, foam, disposable diapers are a major factor. And it turns out that they're not. They are... a much lower percentage than what we were originally expecting. I'm trying to find the percentage.
So what they did is
one third of 1% of total volume.
They took a look and they looked at all the information and all the stuff in the refuse piles and categorized it by time period. Well, they've been doing this over 20 years. So
they've been
year
doing this over 20 years, watching the
okay,
stuff
so
comes
how,
in.
So you're saying is that fast food wrappers, we assume, because we seem to collect that kind of junk in our cars and things, that would be a large percentage of the amount of trash, and it's not. It's a small percentage.
Right, but of the 14 tons of garbage from the 9 municipal landfills that they were watching,
sure.
Less than 100 pounds of fast food packaging
almost nothing.
Were found. Yeah.
Well, kind of makes sense, considering the fast food company has to sell a lot of this stuff. They want to use as little as possible, and they're going to make it light.
And that was something that was very interesting, was that, for example, plastics. If you go further back in time, plastics were more dense, and they were heavier. They had a higher plastic count. Now, If you look at milk jugs, for example, they are thinner and they have a lower resin percentage in that plastic. So less plastic is going in, even if you're
even if we're doing more of it. Mm-hmm. Or what about newspapers? Did you get them percentage for newspapers, since that was your concern that people are reading too many newspapers?
Right. Newspapers weren't as big as I thought they were going to be, but they are still an issue. Newspapers ended up being...
Let's just do percentage.
You got it.
The other big one, when you're looking that up... Is
well, it was... I don't know specifically about newspapers, although it was...
Papers.
It's somewhere in here, but it's some 40% of 25-year-old garbage at this one particular landfill was organics. So newspaper, paper material, and... long clippings and the like. And while there will be some outgassing and some decomposition at the top levels, after a certain time, there is no decomposition. In fact, they were able to dig down and find newspapers documenting the New Deal.
Wow. In perfect condition.
Readable. Yeah, okay. Absolutely readable. They were able to find carrot tops and onion peelings from 20 years ago.
So organic material needs oxygen to break down.
Right, and landfills
so
tend to be
fairly sealed. Are you going to stand by your idea that people shouldn't read newspapers?
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Maybe eat more junk food?
But I don't know that it's that terrible that we're not reading a physical newspaper. That it might be a good thing that we are getting our news online more and more.
Do you read news every day?
In general, I do, yes.
Do you read only technology sector news?
No. I read BBC, the
just
Christian
general.
Science Monitor... and also I look at Google News that has just an overview of all the news that's happening from
all right,
a lot of different organizations.
Good. So you're well-informed even though you don't actually get your hands dirty with ink.
Right.
All right, Miles.
At least I like to think so.
Miles, thank you very much for the digital perspective on the news.
But let's not even talk about what tech is like in landfill.
Oh, tech. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, like circuit boards and gear.
Just guess what you'll find the circuit boards
but it's
buried
not that
now.
High, but
guess what you'll find in 100 years.
Oh, yeah, but gosh. It's not a high volume, though. And it's the same thing as with newspapers.
Not
the
yet.
Newspapers aren't.
You know what? I remember a speech about if you go to a – I don't know where this came from. Maybe it's totally anecdotal. I don't know if it's true. But if you go to a grocery store and you look down the aisles, within 1 week, all that stuff will be either consumed by humans or in landfills or recycled. So the grocery store, if you will, goes through most of their inventory on a weekly process. So when you look down the diaper alley, that's always the one that gets me because those, of course, aren't consumed. Stuff's added to them and they're putting it in the garbage.
You know, there are, what, the seventh generation diaper? Is that what it is, Lyle? Sixth or seventh generation diaper? They're brown. They're supposed to be much better in landfills.
Yeah, I guess they are. The ones that you're using. The more expensive ones.
They're more expensive.
This is Geek Speak in the air with Sean Cleveland. I'm Lyle Troxell, and we have Miles Elam. We also have support from Rick Philman answering the phones. We'll be taking your calls in just a little bit, and Dee Dee Hubbard is joining us through Yahoo and Semester to keep us honest and hip. The next news story, Sean.
Daylight savings time has changed. You want to make sure your gadget knows this, because a lot of gadgets aren't going to update themselves to the new times. So it's springing forward 3 weeks earlier. It will begin at 2 a.m. Sunday, March 11th, and will end a week later than usual on Sunday, November 4th.
Now this, I don't understand why they changed it.
It's because of a massive federal energy bill that passed in 2005 that adds extra hours of daylight in the hope of decreasing national energy consumption.
Okay, so that would be great if we actually got some energy savings out of this. Okay, I'm all for that. But the idea in 2095 of changing this means that any applications...
2005. Just 2 years ago.
Okay, 2 years ago. Any applications written before then, any programs that was written before then...
Right.
Are wrong. And it's so frustrating to me. I mean, like, I don't know. It's...
Yeah.
And my old...
Especially
handhelds. My little watch that's somewhere...
A company's going to update a handheld for minuscule amount of time, a year or two, before they don't make updates anymore because they're on to the next technology, next product, and they don't have the resources to go back and keep updating these products that they've built that are, you know, people are still using.
So remind everybody you know that their clocks are probably not going to automatically change for daylight savings if you're normally used to that. Keep track of it. Use a newspaper.
Yeah.
And find out what are the dates again for daylight savings this year.
Okay, we'll begin at 2 a.m. Sunday, March 11th.
March 11th, very important day.
And we'll end on Sunday, November 4th.
Okay, we'll cover that one later on, but March 11th is the daylight savings time. Next news story, Mr. Elam. I know that Sean has another one stacked up because he's so on top of it, but if you'd like. Oh, Sean, Mr. Cleveland, next.
Oh.
You mentioned something before the show, and now I'm blanking on what it was. It was so interesting. Oh, it was the thing about doctors and handwriting. You want to talk about that?
You know, I don't have that story.
Oh, okay.
But it was interesting. yeah. You know, I'll find it again.
I'm sorry.
I'll bring it back up. You know, I want to talk to Miles about, here's what we were talking about while you were out of the room.
Okay.
Was internet connectivity throughout the world and how good it is in other countries and just how bad it is here in the U.S.
Ah, yes.
Is your girlfriend
Let's talk
DSL
about this. This is really interesting stuff.
This is one where there was a the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and also the International Telecommunications Union have done studies on adoption rates of broadband and internet availability, pricing, and the like. The United States currently ranks 12th in broadband adoption rates.
In every single country or in the top?
Single country.
So we're the only one still doing the metric system, the English system, not doing
the imperial system, right.
And the imperial system?
I love that's the name of it. And the thing is, the England, where the imperial system came from, yeah, they're going to metric.
Yeah, they've been metric a while. Okay, so, but we're the only one that's using the imperial system of measurement.
No, and we're not the only one.
Yeah.
And we're also like two 12th. Other countries.
There are two other countries, yeah.
That I've never heard of, right? Anyway, that's because I'm not educated. I don't read enough news. So this is not about, this is specifically...
Right, so this is about how many people, of all the citizens, people who are getting internet access, how many have access to broadband?
What percentage?
And what the growth rate of that is specifically. We're 12th in line?
Well, it's not the growth rate. It's what percentage of your population is connected to the internet at higher than, and they have as their baseline, 200 kilobits per second, which is a minimal broadband.
And that's where the U.S. really just falls over.
Right, and...
So we might
this
have
is
a lot
a contrast
of people connected,
to we
a lot
were
of dial-up.
In 2001, we were fourth. So this has mostly happened in the last 6 years. We had dropped from fourth to 12th.
Now, are a lot of these countries still have government run phone companies and cable companies? Because I know that that's unique.
I bet you it's more to do with infrastructure and the fact that a lot of countries are getting a brand new infrastructure, which supports these high speeds.
Well, there's that, but U.S. is unusual in that we have our what we call the last mile, who's actually connecting up to our doorstep. We're regulated monopolies for a long period of time, and now now that deregulation has occurred, they're now just large companies that don't have as much oversight as they used to. And so these studies are finding is the biggest hindrance. Are these last mile companies, the AT&Ts, the Comcast?
But that is a reason for that is the as Sean said, the older infrastructure, these copper twisted pairs that are sending to the houses, where new people didn't necessarily have phones, so they're getting the new services and it's really good. But I would argue that most of the companies that are at a low level of technology emerging up are just going cell phones. They're not even putting in wireless infrastructure. So what is their bandwidth? What are they using? Are they using wireless?
Well, we're talking about really high speed internet.
Yeah, so where's
200
that
megabit
from?
Per second.
Is that fiber going to the
up
house?
Up and down. I would think it's fiber.
Probably. Fiber to give you an idea of speeds we're talking about here, this isn't, we have 6 megabit or 14 megabit and they have 20 megabit. Korea and Japan offer in excess of 100 megabits per second. In other words, land speed.
It's like a local
like
area,
local
network.
Area yeah. network.
We're not talking about handheld.
Hey, speaking of, okay, so basically,
and the
United States
the cost,
sat on high-speed
their
access.
Their cost is much better than ours
yeah.
for that higher speed.
Sure.
Yeah, we are spending more money for much slower, for one-tenth the speed.
And they're not blocked for uploads, which is incredible. Here, our upload speed is, one-fifth, one-eighth of our download speed, whatever. It's just really horrible.
You know, it probably sounded to be one-third, but yeah.
It feels like one-eighth to me.
Right, but Korea, for example, offers 100 megabit upload and download.
Unbelievable. How do we get to this? And not pay hundreds of dollars a month for it.
Move to Korea.
And you know what? There are new technologies now that require these high speeds, like ITV. I hear it's beautiful. All the companies are in the UK because it's the European countries who can actually get it. Yeah. In the United States, you try and watch this, and it's unwatchable because our speeds are so low.
Now, on a more personal note, I would love to be able to use my cell phone as a modem. I would love to be able to have like a Bluetooth dongle and do that. I've seen it happen. I saw Chris Dunphy doing it 5 years ago. And yet, when I looked at my plans, like with my provider, to do that, even at a minimal level, is something like $100 a month. You know, $80 to $100 a month.
Yeah.
And it's for
forget it. For low,
for something,
for low
balance. For something that's only, you know, 75 kilobits a second or 150 kilobits a second.
GeekSpeak is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. Right after GeekSpeak today, we have Castle Cottage. Today, storytelling and songs from down on the bayou, celebrating the spirit of the Mardi Gras with the people of the state of Louisiana. That's at 11 a.m. following GeekSpeak.
KUSP co-sponsors Amnesty International of Santa Cruz County's annual spaghetti dinner and raffle. Well, that's a mouthful. KUSP, Amnesty International, spaghetti dinner and raffle. There you go. This all-vegetarian dinner and silent auction begins at 6 p.m. with a raffle to follow dinner at 7:30 p.m. Bring the whole family and come to the Live Oaks Senior Center at 1777 Capitola Road at the intersection of Capitola Road and 7th Avenue in Santa Cruz. For more info, please call 295-9354.
What date?
Wow. It doesn't say.
Oh, no. Okay, so.
It's just at
6 the phone PM. Numbers again. Give the phone numbers again.
295-9354. Wow.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're taking your calls with questions and comments starting right now. You can call us up on the telephone. Rick will patch you into the line. You can ask anything you'd like about technology. We'll take any call you have for us, providing that it's sane and we can understand you. We might not answer you correctly, but we'll definitely try to help. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or you can call toll-free anywhere in California, 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. If you'd like to send us an email, you're welcome to do so by going, well, you don't go to a website this time, just send an email to geeks@geekspeak.org. Geeks@geekspeak.org.
Kyle.
Wait. Business with Pleasure, supported by... Oh, you got it?
No, go.
Okay. Business with Pleasure, supported GeekSpeak today. A full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, and delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, and waiting on the phone with bated breath for your calls with questions and comments of technology is Rick. Rick will take your call, punch it into the air room with us, as long as you call and ask his questions. 476-2800, toll-free, at 1-800-655-5877. Sean, please.
That doctor's sloppy handwriting.
Oh, that's the news story. Yeah.
So this is the title. Let's try making doctor's sloppy handwriting more legible with electronic prescribing and save 7,000 lives in the U.S. alone each year.
So that's presumed that every year 7,000 people die because a prescription wasn't read correctly.
Kills more than 7,000 people annually. It's shocking. Preventable medication mistakes also injure more than 1.5 million Americans annually. That's not killing, it's just injuring them. And, it's not a bad idea possibly to move to little electronic gadgets that prevent this sort of thing. Yeah, there's a whole story on this.
Let's put that story up on the
site, Time Magazine, too. And we'll put it up on the web, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We should have mentioned on Dr. Dawn, of course. We should have given that story to her. Maybe she did cover it. I didn't listen to the show today. We are taking calls now with questions and comments to technology from Santa Cruz. Jane, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question today?
Hi, Lyle. This is Jane Wade.
Hi, Jane.
A question. You were talking the other day, I think it was last week, about doing websites, setting up websites. And I'm about to take that on. And I'm dealing with my son, and I'm trying to figure out which of the various options for doing it I should use. There's MediaWiki.
Oh, you're going to set up a... Uh-huh.
I'm doing it. I have to learn it.
Okay, are you managing your own website?
Carson's going to manage it for... Yes.
Okay.
We're going to manage it.
And you want to have a wiki?
Well,
Let me just be clear. A wiki, it's a Hawaiian word, I believe, meaning fast. And a wiki is the type of software that runs a website that allows anybody, or at least the people that you want to, edit the site, any pages, all of it, and create new pages really easily. It's not the best for, most of the time, it's not the best for navigation structures, and information architecture is a little complicated doing it, but it's very successful because you have a lot of contributors. the biggest example of this is Wikipedia. Wikipedia does use MediaWiki.
I want to do, because I do know what a wiki is.
Good.
But MediaWiki has, I mean, you can set up a website using a wiki, right? Without having to have it be a wiki.
Whoa. I'm already lost, Jane.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out the best way to set up a fairly simple website that probably in the future I can add a discussion to, but I don't really have to deal with that.
Okay,
anymore.
And are you hosting your own computer for this, your own server, or are you going through an internet service provider?
No, I'm probably going to use an internet service provider.
Okay, do you already have one chosen? Because if you're already stuck with the internet service provider, you need to look at what resources they provide to you and see what you can do on their system.
And do you have the domain already?
I have a domain, but I own the domain.
Okay.
Right now I have the domain. I'm running my email through my son's server.
Uh-huh.
So everything is in-house.
Okay. Okay. Well, I have used MediaWiki. I've also used a thing called PHPWiki. A wiki, yeah, basically what you do is you install a bunch of software on the server, and then it runs all the paths of that URL is handled by the wiki. There's a database involved as well.
Okay.
So, Jane, specifically, you're asking whether when you install that, it will start working? I don't exactly understand your question.
I want to know if I don't use that to design my website, what should I use? What are my options for dealing with a fairly simple website?
Okay. Do you want to be able to edit it through a web browser?
As opposed to what?
Editing with a local client, the most common one is Dreamweaver. You make your changes, you look at it, then you upload it to FTP to the web server. So one is a static site, meaning a whole bunch of HTML documents and images, and the other is a dynamic database-driven model.
Oh, I understand. I think the first. I don't want to go the route of Dreamweaver. I don't want to have to take on proprietary software if I don't have to.
Okay. Well, there are some free pretty good WYSIWYG editors out there, but if you're looking and interested in making it very easy to add and modify content, a wiki is a great solution. Other than that, you want to look for content management systems, CMSs. There's a whole bunch out there. One comes to mind that's pretty popular right now is called Drupal, and Drupal runs on PHP and I believe multiple databases. There's also a thing called Django, which starts with a D, Django, and it runs on Python. Again, these things are complex. They're relatively easy to use. I would say that Drupal is a little easier to install as a base level running system for content management. But you're going to come in restrictions. If you like the idea of a wiki, I would use a wiki. And MediaWiki is a great application. Allows a lot of support, and people start knowing how to use the navigation pretty easily if they visit Wikipedia.
Right.
So, Jane, I think that's my recommendation to you is go ahead and go with that wiki idea.
Good.
Thanks. Good luck. Thanks for the call.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to you. Bye. Bye-bye. In Santa Cruz, Gary, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Let's see. I've got a real geek question. I've had my second Seagate drive in a row running Windows not boot.
Mm-hmm.
The first one gave me, I think, you know, some fancy smart error. It figured out it was going to crash in it. Did something preemptively, and so I was able to replace that and get all my data on the new drive. And now, maybe 8 months later, the second drive's doing the same thing. Or even worse, I got the blue screen of death.
Now, blue screen doesn't necessarily mean it's the hard drive failing. Go ahead.
I'm not sitting in front of my computer right now, but when I looked up, it said Hive error. I'm trying to remember. I tried to recover.
Did you Google that error?
I did. I Googled it, and it said basically drive failure.
Huh. I'm not familiar with that one. Have you contacted Seagate?
I didn't this time. I went down to a local store I like a lot and talked to them, and they said, yeah, drive's dying. So I decided to buy a Western Digital drive.
You should have gotten the drive. I mean, if you only owned it for a year,
you should get it under warranty.
It's under warranty. You should work with Seagate and get that drive replaced, make them pay for it.
I may still do that, but I just kind of wanted my computer
running.
Yeah, because a store is going to tell you, yeah, your hard drive's dying, buy a new one.
Yeah, because they like the idea of you buying one.
yeah, I know what you mean. Although they're pretty good guys down there, but so here's my current situation.
Uh-huh.
I bought an enclosure, so I'm able to access the drive and get my data off it. So far,
is it still dying on you and having problems in that enclosure?
once it actually, I tried to do one big massive backup, like image copy, and, you know, it was going to take 4 hours, and when I turned around, you know, 3 hours later, it had rebooted the system. It wasn't even the boot drive. But my current challenge to zoom in on it.
I think you're having another problem with your computer. I don't think it has to do with the hard drive.
Okay, what because, kind of, like, a motherboard problem? Or?
Well, the system shouldn't have rebooted.
Because of a USB drive having a problem. It would have just given an error saying this USB drive's having a problem.
Right.
It was actually a SATA drive in this case, SATA.
Oh, you're doing external SATA?
Yeah, external SATA. So, the enclosure is a SATA.
Right.
Well, the enclosure is a SATA, but how are you connecting to the computer? External SATA?
Let's see. It's got a...
FireWire or USB? I bet it's USB.
SATA,
external SATA. External SATA is pretty uncommon.
It is uncommon. But it's certainly picking up traction.
Basically, I got the little expansion slot.
Yeah.
Let me just think for a second.
It should not have taken your computer down. So it does. I have to agree with Lyle that there's something else going on.
Yeah. And the thing I would try, because it's easy, is turn off your machine, pull one of the RAM sticks, if you've got two RAM sticks, and see if that's the problem. But is there a better way to diagnose what might be the problem for him, Sean?
I would diagnose the hard drive first. You might want to, it'll become a drive letter in your system. Right-click on the drive letter and go to Tools, or select Properties, go to Tools and do a check disk and do a full check disk.
On the one in the enclosure, one that was failing?
Yeah.
Okay, so do a check disk even before I got all my data off it?
Oh, yeah, check disk won't hurt you. It'll actually might clean up the system enough where you can get the data off.
But you want to do a full bit-for-bit check disk so it checks everything and make sure that if there are any issues, it'll remap them.
Gary, thank you very much for the call.
But I wouldn't trust the drive so much if there are issues, for sure. But get your data off it, and then start looking at your Windows system or your actual computer, because there's something else going on there.
Okay. Do you need to boot me off?
Yeah, I'm going to go on to the next call, but thank you very much for the call, Gary.
Send an email to geeks, or just go to geekspeak.org.
No, that
doesn't work. Send an email to geeks@geekspeak.org, and I can try and help you.
Thank you much.
Yeah. Thank you, Gary. Bye-bye. From Big Sur, Stephen, welcome to Geekspeak.
Thank you. I heard you talking about Gmail,
yes.
But a couple of questions about that. I've been trying to switch over from AOL to Gmail, and I've been using it for a while. I'm curious what mail apps you've been using to take it. Are you doing the work right on Google?
I'm using Gmail, the web interface, using Firefox as my browser.
Okay, and directly there. Are you storing it on your computer then, too?
No, I'm not storing it on my computer. I'm letting Gmail store all of it.
And if I want to store it on my computer also?
You can get an IMAP. You can connect through IMAP. I mean, sorry, POP through Google and get a local copy of the mail.
Right.
What operating system are you on?
I'm using Mac OS, the latest version I'm using right now. I've been trying to use mail.
I haven't
tried
it.
I've been using it as a POP.
And is it working? Is it copying the mail over?
For the most part, I'm not completely happy with the mail application.
Well, then the other mail application that I suggest is Thunderbird. It's Mozilla's. It's kind of a sister project to Firefox.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, mozilla.org to get it.
Okay.
Thunderbird's a really wonderful email client, and I know that a lot of people use Thunderbird with Gmail. It's kind of the same paradigm of thought to some degree, the people that use it. And that's a good idea, because then you have a local copy. Even if you don't have internet access, you have a copy to your mail. Because sure enough, if I don't have internet, I don't have email right now.
Yeah, and I'm in Big Sur, and it'd be nice to be able to have it on my computer. And I've really been liking Firefox a lot. Real impressed with that. The other thing I was thinking, too, about just to the earlier caller, I don't know if it's any good or not, but I was playing around with it. Google has like a beta version of their own websites that you can build from templates that's for free. I don't know the quality of them.
From a template?
Yeah, Google has this place where you can now build websites.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Pages. It's called
Pages.
Google Pages.
Yeah,
that's
so
true.
I played with it, and real quickly I was able to make some pages. It's just drop and drag.
They also have, I think they also own Blogger.
They
which
do.
Which allows you to make, blogs. And they'll host everything for you, and it's free.
That's right. The newer version of the Blogger, they host for you. The older version of Blogger, which you can choose for, you can host back to your own domain.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
But the newer version, they don't let you.
So that is a good idea for the person that called in before, for Jane, who wanted to know about putting up a website. You could definitely use a free service to host a website. I believe Yahoo offers the same type of thing. But Pages at Google is the place if you want to try that out. Hey, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Stephen, for the
thank
call.
You guys for all the work you do. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
In Ben Lomond, Randy, welcome to GeekSpeak, my hometown.
All right, cool. Go Ben Lomond. Good morning, you guys. We just want to let you know, enjoy your show. And can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, good. We're having a problem with our ancient 6-year-old computer that is running Windows ME. But we thought we'd give you guys a call and see what you think about this problem we're having. Our monitor has gotten temperamental and keeps deciding to turn itself off every couple of seconds.
And how do you get it to turn back on?
Well, about the only thing I figured out is restarting the computer and just being patient until it's, like I said, it's temperamental.
Are you pretty sure that the computer's not turning off, it's just the monitor?
Oh, it's just the monitor. It's definitely just the monitor.
How do you know that?
Well, what'll happen is typically I'll start up the computer and it starts up just fine. And then I'll open Internet Explorer, and in the process of the browser window opening up, the monitor just clicks right off.
Goes
into, like, standby mode.
Okay, and is...
Well, I turn the monitor back on, and I can see that the browser is still, you know, opening, and the window will open, and after, you know,
15
seconds, it clicks off.
So the monitor itself is actually turning off.
Yeah.
Okay, get a new monitor. But do not turn your computer back on and off. That's just bad for the computer, and there's no reason.
Unless the video card is losing a signal for some reason.
Huh. Why would the video signal? I mean, the video signal is not sending the signal anymore.
Right.
But he turns the monitor off, turns back on, and it resets the. I guess. I mean, it's possible. That
okay,
it
so you're not
signal.
Turning the computer off, just the monitor. You turn the monitor. Back.
Well, I turn the monitor at first. I'll turn the monitor, you know, back on again. You know, I'll turn it off and then turn it back on. Just to be able to restart the computer so I can see the screen. And sometimes, you know, it's like 2 or 3 times. And then, like I said, it's temperamental. All of a sudden, it'll just, you know, no problem at all.
Right.
The computer's not, the monitor's not getting turned off. It's just going into a standby mode.
Right.
The green light goes like the yellow, and you've lost your signal.
Yes.
And then you push that button again, and it
you turn it off,
on.
And then you turn it back on, and you can see the screen again.
And for about 15 seconds until it clicks back off into standby.
Okay, access to another computer monitor?
We've got
to
make sure the computer's not going into some...
Yeah, it's
not turning the monitor off, because sleep mode can turn the monitor off after a certain amount of time.
I would suggest this. Do you have access to another monitor?
Not really,
okay.
But...
Here's some tricks about monitors. You can, if it's a normal non-DVI, which is old enough, it's just a VGA monitor, you can take that cable off while the computer's running. You can plug another monitor on while the computer's running. You can borrow somebody's monitor. It's not going to damage anything, and try it on your computer. The biggest thing about monitors, if they're CRTs, is they be careful you don't hurt yourself, because when you lift over your desk to lift up the monitor, it's heavy and you can strain yourself. So monitors are really, you can move them on and off all the time. I would think the first thing to do, because it's easy, is to try another monitor on your computer. And I got to say that people throw away CRTs now. It costs money to get rid of these things. So it's not that hard to find them. Ask a friend or a geek. If you've got a neighbor who's kind of friendly, ask if you can borrow their monitor, try it out. Now, if that doesn't work, Sean, what does he do?
The first thing you should do is go to your control panel and go to power options and make sure the monitor isn't being told to turn off after a certain period of time.
His machine works for a long time, and then it turns off, and then he moves stuff and he has to turn it back on. It's not a setting.
Yeah,
like
he's
that.
Losing the video sync. To the monitor.
I get that.
This is exactly what Windows does when it turns the monitor off.
Yeah, but it works for a long time, and then it turns off, and then...
Well, this will happen, actually, just when I first booted up the computer.
Yeah, it happens right away. But definitely try this out.
Definitely check your power options, and make sure that when the computer's plugged in, that nothing turns off.
Okay, so let's say it's not the power options, which is my assumption, and it's not the monitor. What does he do at that point?
It sounds like the monitor's going, then.
But it could be the graphics card, right?
Well, the best way to test that, like Lyle said, is just get another monitor and see if the same behavior happens. If then you see the same thing, it's definitely your graphics card.
And can he buy a new graphics card for that computer?
Oh, yeah. There's still AGP graphics cards available. I'm guessing it's... What year is the machine, do you know?
It was purchased in 2000. It's a Dell.
Yeah.
Might be PCI.
Most likely AGP.
Yeah, most likely AGP. So you want to get an AGP graphics card to replace it if you need a graphics... And you know what? At this point, I would call us back or email us, geeks@geekspeak.org, help you a little bit. But Santa Cruz, you're in Ben Lomond, so Santa Cruz Electronics can help you out with getting a new card for your computer. Thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, can I ask one more quick question?
Okay, Randy, go ahead.
Well, I've kind of come up with a temporary solution to the problem. Since the last time that we were able to get it to stay on without turning itself off, we just decided to not turn the computer off. And I'm wondering, I mean, that's been working for the last 4 days. But I'm wondering, is that going to kill my computer to leave it on all the time.
It will hurt your energy bill, and and your machine will have to be rebooted eventually. Because Windows...
Well, system resources just restarted. You don't have to, you don't have to repower the machine.
Right, but will it kill the machine by running it... No.
In fact,
I run mine all the time, too.
It's more damaging to the computer to turn it on and off.
It is more damaging to turn it on and off all the time.
But your power bill is different. Randy, thank you so much for your
call.
All
right, I appreciate you guys. Thanks.
Bye-bye. But don't just live with it doing that, right? I mean, that's the thing is that, yeah, you could just let it be like that. But getting a new monitor is not a big deal. And let's do this, too. Back up your computer data because your hard drive will fail eventually.
If you're going to leave it on all the time, get a flat panel. They don't consume as much power.
That's a good point. And actually, if you're going to leave your computer on all the time, make sure to turn your monitor off because it uses so much power.
That's true.
I don't think that would work for him. Monterey, Diane, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there. My name's Diane.
How's it going to Monterey today?
It's too gorgeous.
Too gorgeous.
Yeah.
There was this great segment on Talk of the Bay a week ago about the museums in Monterey. You know, I'm in Santa Cruz, and I visit the museums sometimes with my kids, but there are so many great locations up and down the coast, and I keep on meaning to get down to Monterey with my kids to do museums, but that's not why you're calling. So what's your question today?
I don't know if they're going to do this every year, but last weekend they had interactive things at the Monterey Museum of Art with families and kids and stuff.
That's right.
It was really cool. And also my museum for the kids down on Washington.
Now, I'm actually going to one of those, I think, in a week in San Jose, at San Jose Museum of Modern Art.
Oh, yeah.
Same kind of thing, where you get to go in with your kids. I don't know if there's a fee or not, but there's a whole bunch of activities for children to do, and you get to play and paint and all that stuff. Sean, I'd love you to come with me if you want to do that.
Yeah, possibly.
All right, so, but what's your technical question today?
Well, just to tag on to that last conversation you were having with the previous caller, it's better to turn your... It's bad to turn your computer on and off instead of leaving it in sleep mode or something. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Basically, every time you boot your computer from cold, off to on, the drive has to be accessed and a whole bunch of stuff. A whole bunch of stuff has to be added to memory. You have all the components that are cold that have to then be... increased in temperature, which is stressful on the components. So that cycle, that start and stop cycle, is the thing that's actually damaging on, like, hard drive components, things of that nature.
Yeah.
If you keep them at a constant temperature and constant state, it's better for the components.
But if you're going to keep it on, get a UPS. You want to make sure your computer's getting clean energy and not lots of spikes, because that can really hurt your computer.
And another thing that really
especially
hurts
in the mountains.
Computer, a power failure really is not a good thing for computer. When you unplug the power cord or you push the button down, you just hold it in, it's not good for Windows.
Nope.
It's not good for the hard drive.
And a UPS has a little USB connector that you plug into your computer. The computer recognizes this, and it will gracefully shut down if the power goes out.
So UPS is an uninterrupted power supply. It's basically a large battery. You plug it in, it charges up the battery, you plug your computer into that. When the power gets turned off at the house or momentarily stopped,
if it goes out,
the computer stays on.
And then when the battery gets to a point, it tells the computer time to shut down.
You only got about 5-10 minutes.
And it'll shut down gracefully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any case, though.
Okay. My real question was, I belong to a group of, a photography group, and there's about 150...
That's a big group.
It is. They don't all come to the meetings. But there's about 150 people I need to notify about upcoming meetings.
Ah.
How do I do that?
Do you normally do meetings? That's mostly what you do with this group? Okay, I would highly recommend a site called meetup.com. It's meetup.com. Yeah. I'm involved in a meetup group for Ruby on Rails, a programming environment. But what you do is you make this account. Everybody creates an account and gets added to it. They modify their own email address. And whenever you have a meeting, you set up your meeting scheduled ahead of time. They've got a whole bunch of features for planning out your events. And basically, everybody that wants to participate in it gets to add it in, and they can manage how much email they get and if they get the announcements. And basically, you're going to do one thing. You're going to reduce the size of the 100 group to a more manageable size, to the people that are actually active. And you're going to have a place that keeps track of all the meetings and is kind of open so people can join. You can also set it up so that you control who gets to join and not if you want to be
private. What about Yahoo Groups?
Yahoo Groups does the same thing to some degree. The thing with Yahoo Groups is it's very broad. It's got a form. It's got all this stuff. And if you've got all these features, pictures, all these other things, you might not need all of it. But then again, Yahoo Groups does allow you to upload pictures. So if you're a photo group, it might be a useful thing to do. But I definitely recommend an online service.
Okay.
Right now, are you just pasting in a whole bunch of emails to your email group, your email client, and mailing it out?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what I'm doing is I'm blind copying, like...
See, that's horrible. Yeah, because spam filters look for that. A bunch of blind copies? Well, looks like spam.
They look for messages that aren't actually sent to the person that is receiving them.
So all your people may not be getting your messages.
So until I set this up, what would I do in order to get my message out?
Send it to each person individually.
Holy moly. Okay.
Another thing to do, I don't know if Thunderbird supports this feature, but some email clients, what email client are you using?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm using AT&T Yahoo.
Yeah. See, if you're using AT&T Yahoo, I don't know if they actually support this, but the general idea is you make a group with your address book. And your group with your address book, you then say, send to this group, and it'll actually send an individual message to each one of those people. But that's normally not enabled because the internet service providers don't actually like that, because then they get a lot more traffic through their email server rather than just saying this group gets...
Yeah, and I've gotten messages saying your limit of emails, something about the limiting of my emails for the day.
Yeah, what they're trying to do is they're trying to fight all this spamming that's happening. And what's going on is these machines get taken over, zombied, and they send a whole bunch of emails. And the ISPs go, you know what? Most people don't send more messages than maybe 50 messages a day. So we're just going to say you can't send more than 50 messages a day. And then they don't even tell you about it or anything. And then you get this error message. You can then contact them and say, you know what? Make that larger because I actually send a lot of emails.
Right.
And they will. Because they don't really want to restrict you. They just want to make sure that it's not a spamming problem.
Now, I have one more recommendation. If you have Microsoft Word, there is a feature called Mail Merge.
That's a good idea.
And I would tell you how to get to it. But just go and up in the right-hand corner, it says type a question for help. Type in Mail Merge, and it'll tell you how to use it. And basically, you create a list of people, and then you create an email in Word, and it'll automatically send those to those people.
Individually.
But it's not very flexible.
Yeah, it's kind of
I would go to meetup.com and set that up and get it.
Okay.
It's going to be much better.
A meet
for
group
you.
Is great for you guys because you'll be able to plan the events. You'll set where the location is. It's just a wonderful thing to do.
Good.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know what's nice about those sites, too, is they offer you a place where everybody can go.
Yeah, exactly. You can see what the group's like, how active it is. You can actually get a kind of central location.
It's kind of cool.
Meetup doesn't do a lot of features that Yahoo Groups does.
You know what I like about Yahoo Groups?
What?
I belong to some groups, and I don't like getting all these emails from everybody. When you got a large group, I mean, I could really fill your inbox fast. You can actually set it up so you get one email, and it gives you all the emails from that day.
Yeah, it's called what is that called? I can't now remember it. It's one of the email settings. You're going to get to it in a second. It is consolidation. Well, I don't know what the name of it is, but anyway. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers for appointments and more information, 423-2447. What is it called?
Digest.
Digest, right.
It's a setting, and you just say, give me email digest, and then you get it all in one day.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The Geeks today, that was Sean Cleveland. Sean, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Lyle.
You're, of course, work for NVIDIA, a large manufacturer of motherboards, motherboard chipsets, and graphics cards.
It's all true.
It's all
true. We do make motherboards now.
Thank you, Sean, for being here every week.
Yeah,
I really appreciate
you.
It. Miles Elam was also here in the air room with us. Miles recently quit his job doing spam protection stuff for surf control and now is studying to be an English teacher in high school?
High school and middle school, yeah.
All right. Next week on GeekSpeak, we'll be here, as we are every week, learn a bit about dynamic HTML and fighting spam at the same time. Danny Goodman joins the Geeks for discussion of his new books, Dynamic HTML, The Definitive Guide, and Spam Wars. Another book of his. That's Saturday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP.